Hi, this is Rob Diaz de Villegas, host of WFSU's Coast to Canopy. The following is a bonus episode, an extended segment from our radio show, Speaking Of. The topic, one of my favorite critters, the eastern indigo snake.
Hi, I'm Gina Jordan, a host here at WFSU Public Media. Today we are speaking of the eastern indigo snake. This non-venomous species is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, and it's making a comeback thanks to efforts by folks at the Nature Conservancy in Florida. Here's audio of then-North Florida program manager David Prentice in 2020 finding an indigo snake near a gopher tortoise burrow where these snakes spend the winter.
All right, here's something interesting. So I would say pretty sure that there's an indigo in this burrow or somewhere right around here. Do you see this right here? That is a snake crawl. And because it, I hear it. There he is. This animal looks as if it is going to shed soon. The eyes are starting to get a little bit milky colored. That's what they do just prior to shedding.
That audio was gathered by Rob Diaz de Villegas of WFSU's Ecology Blog, and he joins me now along with Catherine Ricketts, Preserve Manager with the Nature Conservancy's Apalachicola Bluffs and Ravines Preserve. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Gina.
Welcome. Catherine, tell us about these snake releases that you all have been undertaking for close to a decade now.
That's right. The first snake release was conducted in 2017, and that was after a number of years of planning and coordination and evaluation by federal and state partners with the hope of reintroducing this species back onto the landscape from which it had been extirpated from North Florida essentially since the early 1980s. So we first released snakes in 2017 and have done so annually since then.
And you feel like your efforts have been working, right?
That's correct. This is an untested process for this particular species, but reintroductions of other endangered animals have occurred across the nation and over the years. So there is a foundation for this type of process, but you never know when you embark on an adventure like this how it's going to turn out. But we've had a lot of resources monitoring our efforts since 2017, and so far we feel like it's moving in the right direction.
Great. And so the ninth release is coming up, and Rob, you've been witness to some of these. What can you tell us about how this works when you are observing this?
Right. So everyone gathers together at the headquarters, and they split off into three or four teams, I guess, depending on how they want to break people up. And everyone goes to marked gopher tortoise burrows. So I guess the idea is to sort of imprint them upon sort of where these potential winter shelter areas are for them. You know, you have this pillowcase with a snake in it. It's kind of cool because they're really, you know, thin material so they can breathe in there. And you can see their scales. They have these really large scales, large smooth scales. And you can see the texture of them moving along on the pillowcases when you get them. And then you open it up, take it out, read the number out, they catalog it. And most of them will slither right into the hole when you lay them down. Some don't. But this is kind of fun to watch. You hold the snake, they're really docile, really smooth, really kind of cool to hold. Just kind of fun to think about. This is an animal that will eat an eastern diamondback rattlesnake, and you're holding it, and it's just the calmest, docile snake. And then you put it, and it goes into the gopher tortoise burrow, and you don't see it again until they survey it later on, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Catherine, tell us what these snakes look like.
These snakes are really amazingly beautiful. They're a glossy black color. Under their chin, they might, and along their lower jaw, they have this kind of rusty orange pattern of scales. Their belly is kind of a light blue-gray, but that light blue-gray really lets this iridescent indigo color shine. You can see it on their backs as well, but it's just a beautiful glossy black snake with this iridescent indigo kind of overtone to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and they have a dark black eye, and it's a striking animal.
And this species is native to the southeastern U.S.
That's correct.
And it's also very long. It's like the longest native That's snake right. species in the country, yeah.
Yeah, as far as a native animal, the native snake, it's the longest in North America. They can get up to 8 feet long. And even this past year, we have recaptured an individual that was released 4 or 5 years ago, and this male is already almost 6 feet long.
Wow. Where are we most likely to see an indigo snake?
So although in North Florida they are more uncommon, you know, with only the Apalachicola Bluffs and Ravines Preserve being the known location for these animals because they were reintroduced, they're also in South Alabama, in Georgia, and in peninsular Florida. They're a reptile, so they're warm-blooded. You know, you're going to find them in places when it's cooler that are sunny. If it's in the summertime when it's warmer, they're more likely to be found kind of slithering around swamps or wet areas where there's lots of prey items. Anywhere you can find a snake, if it's a place that indigos can be, they'll be out.
So, and you said they might be in swamps in the summer, but like where you are specifically,
yes.
I mean, you have a really cool geographic feature where they might be found. Talk about steephead ravines.
Sure. So the main reason that Apalachicola Bluffs and Ravines became a preserve owned by the Nature Conservancy was to conserve these unique ravine ecosystems, which are really kind of geologic refuges, geologic time scale refuges for plant species that were more commonly associated with the Appalachians. And so during times of ice age, when the climate was different, the coastline of Florida was different, these plant species were spread more across the whole region from the Appalachians to Florida. When the climate changed and became more like it is today, these ravines had formed because basically the sandhills on which ABRP is located today were barrier islands back when the coastline was different, pure sand. So when the water rainfall hits it, the water percolates down instead of running over the hill. So it goes directly down like a giant water filter, and it hits the clay layer at the base of this 200-ish foot sandhill, and then seeps out towards the Apalachicola River. So it erodes the hill from the bottom and creates these steephead ravines with these streams that are clear, thermoregulated streams, kind of similar temperature every year. And that climate of the ravines has preserved these species of plants that normally would be today found only in the in the Appalachians, not in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So the snakes utilize those in the summertime because they're filled with prey items. They're cooler than the blazing hot sandhills of Florida. So for us, yes, the snakes definitely use the ravines in the summer months.
I'm trying to picture that. It sounds really cool. Is there any public access at the preserve?
There is. We have a trail called the Garden of Eden Trail. It's located just to the north of Bristol, Florida. So that's about 45 minutes from Tallahassee or so to the west. And you can access that trail year-round. It's a very cool trail because you get to experience both the upland sandhills that the Nature Conservancy has worked to restore and the ravine systems. You get to go up and down two different ravines on your journey to the Allen Bluff, which is the largest exposed geologic formation in Florida. And it's basically a 135-foot overlook of the Apalachicola River. So it's a really cool hike.
It's like the highest point above a Florida river you're going to get. And it's a view you're not going to see anywhere else in Florida. And it's more elevation, more kind of up and down hiking than any other trail in Florida, too. I mean, Terrea has some as well because it's the same region.
Yes.
It's a little bit of work to get there, but it's fun. I mean, when you get there, it's great.
Yeah. It sounds beautiful.
Just bring water if you're going in the summertime.
Oh, yeah. Yes. So what caused these indigo snakes to become listed as threatened?
Well, like many species that end up on the endangered species list, it was habitat loss. Then for the indigo snake, given that it is such a beautiful, large, kind of charismatic animal, non-venomous, docile, as Rob said, they were pretty popular with the pet trade. And then in particular, in this part of their range, North Florida, South Georgia, Alabama, that experienced the cold temperatures, unlike South Florida, the snakes using those gopher tortoise burrows as winter refuges kind of subjected them to the same issues that gopher tortoises faced with development and gassing of gopher tortoise burrows for businesses to build things. They kind of became a bycatch issue of destruction of gopher tortoise burrows. And then because they are a large animal, they need a lot of territory. So they're mobile and move around. So roadkill was also another big factor.
Yeah. So the Nature Conservancy is doing these releases of the eastern indigo snake every year. What does that look like? First of all, where do you get the snakes that you release?
So they are captive bred. We work with many partners, as I mentioned, and our breeding facility is with the Central Florida Zoo's Orion Center for Indigo Conservation. So there is the director of that facility, Dr. James Bogan. He directs the captive breeding of these snakes. So they get snakes from like mitigation areas down in peninsular Florida or other sources for these animals, that they breed them in captivity, raise the snakes there for a year. Then they are transferred to Willaca Fish Hatchery, which is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service facility near Jacksonville. And those folks keep the snakes for a second year. So at the end of that second year, around this time, you know, we're getting ready to do the next release in April, the Willaca Fish Hatchery staff will bring our cohort of releasable animals to us, and then we'll set them free into the burrows, as Rob was describing.
How many typically do you release?
So the original plan for the reintroduction project was to have 300 snakes released. That was what the scientists determined would be an adequate number of snakes to develop a self-sustaining population at the preserve, with a goal of 30 snakes released per year. But of course, that depends on the success of the captive breeding. So up until this point, we have not released 30 snakes. It's usually been less.
Okay.
And so last year was the first year that for whatever reason, 2 years prior, had been a great captive breeding year, we were able to release 41.
Oh, wow.
You know, you have a plan, but the snakes aren't always going to be amenable to what we've decided that they should do. So
yes. Yeah. And these are all released on the preserve?
Yes. So we are the second reintroduction site for eastern indigos in this part of their range. The Kaneka National Forest in Alabama was the first one that started the program a couple years before we did. So we share snake resources for release.
Mm-hmm. And so you have your preserve and you're releasing them there. But talk about also, you're helping out Turaya State Park with a large amount of land that could also be become gopher tortoise and indigo snake habitat.
That's correct. So in addition to having the gopher tortoise burrow density and availability at the preserve, before this release even became a reality, TNC staff over the decades had worked tirelessly to restore the upland sandhill longleaf pine wiregrass community. And they took their methods that they developed to Turaya State Park, which is our neighbor to the north, and worked to restore that habitat too. And I believe we're upwards of helping them restore 4,000 acres of their park to this historic longleaf pine wiregrass community. And we've recently extended our survey efforts for the indigo snake into Turaya State Park and started documenting gopher tortoise burrows there in the hopes that, you know, as we keep releasing more snakes, that, you know, they will start using this habitat if they're not already. They already might be there. We just, you know, it takes person power to get out there and look for them.
Yeah. Why should we be concerned about the well-being of the indigo snakes?
In conservation, when you're trying to work towards restoration and bringing back historic ecosystems that used to be on the landscape, you want all the components, right? It's not just about the longleaf pine or the wiregrass. I mean, those are critical, but you want to have the full complement of species present, and that brings back the ecosystem as close as possible to what it might have been. So when you talk about the indigo snake, it is the apex predator of that landscape. And so you want to have the complete suite of species, not just the plants or, you know, certain birds, certain insects. You want it all. And so the indigo snake being an apex predator helps keep all the other species in balance. As Rob said, they do eat venomous snakes. So, you know, if you want to make sure your venomous snake population is in balance, your other snake populations are in balance, bring back that apex predator that will help maintain that system the way it used to be.
Yeah. Can we talk a little about the appearance of venomous versus non-venomous snakes? I think this is of use to
us. Sure. So, you know, yeah, it can be a little disconcerting coming upon a snake unexpectedly on a trail or on a walk. And a lot of the venomous and non-venomous snakes look the same. You know, water snakes are notoriously mistaken for cottonmouths because they have the same kind of brownish color. They're maybe not so patterned, you know, not so, something so obvious that you can tell. But one thing to keep in mind for at least this part of the country, venomous snakes here kind of have a more diamond-shaped head or a wedge-shaped head if you're looking at them. And if you happen to get close enough, and even if you're not that close, you can kind of look at their eye and notice that a venomous snake's pupil is more like a cat's eye, that vertical slit type of pupil, whereas a non-venomous snake will have a pupil that is like our eye, a round pupil. And I feel like when I see a venomous snake in the field, even if I'm not sure if it's cottonmouth or if I'm questioning, is that a water snake or cottonmouth, you just kind of look at that head shape and that eye, you can kind of, you know, has a little bit of a sinister look to it. And that's because of that vertical pupil. So I don't know. Those are my two key things that I look for.
And what about the head shape for the non-venomous?
They're more of just like a, I don't know, like a cylinder with a kind of rounded end by the mouth, right? If it's kind of like if you were to just draw a snake as a kid, and it's just kind of like a tube.
Right. The shape has to do, I guess, it's a part of it is the muscles, but also, I guess, the venom glands in there.
I'm not going to say I'm an expert on snake physiology, but I would say, yes, it's got to be part of that.
And if you see, you know, if you're out somewhere in North Florida, maybe you're close to the preserve and you see a black snake, is it necessarily an indigo snake?
No, most commonly, the black snakes that people will see in their yards, or even if you're near the preserve, it's going to be a black racer. It can be difficult if you've never seen an indigo snake in the wild to know for sure that it's not an indigo. But the main difference is that if you see a long black snake, it's probably a racer if it's a more slender animal. By the time indigo snakes get to be 3 or 4 feet long, they're kind of chunky. You mm-hmm. know, they're a full-bodied snake, right? And the other main difference is that black racers are a matte black. They don't have a glossy sheen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some differences with the head shape, but I think that is more challenging if you've never seen the indigo versus a black racer. But certainly the more slender body and the matte black color. And then also, I think if people have experienced encounters with black racers, I mean, they're called racers for a reason. They slither away with a quickness. Whereas, as Rob said, you know, the indigo is just kind of a docile animal. I think it's just not concerned because it knows it's sort of the king of the world here.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just hangs out. It's like, oh, well, I'm just here, whatever, you know, just look at me. I'm the emperor of the forest.
Yeah. And the black racers are what we might see in a Tallahassee neighborhood?
100%.
Okay.
Yes.
Fred.
Yeah, Fred.
We call those Fred in our house.
Yeah.
Your neighborhood Fred.
Yes. So what will it take to stop these releases? What kind of numbers do you need to see to be able to stop releasing these indigo snakes?
So that is an ongoing discussion, and actually there was just a meeting held at the end of February with all of the partners that have been involved in this reintroduction program, both in Florida and Alabama, to discuss what success means. And the target goal is still 300 snakes to be released, but it's still in discussion as to when we think that our populations are self-sustaining. We need to certainly document more on-site reproduction by the released snakes, continued documentation of survivorship of both the males and females released, because the staff at the Fish and Wildlife Service and the OCIC and Welaka Fish Hatchery make sure that we're trying to release an equal number approximately of males and females each year. So we want to make sure that both sexes are surviving, because obviously you're not going to get too much reproduction if you've only got all males or all females. So, you know, just continuing to track as best as we can over the years, like how the snakes are doing, how they're surviving, and certainly more juvenile documentation.
Right. And I don't think we've talked about that, but you have had some evidence of reproduction.
We have. It was really exciting in the fall of 2023. We were able to find on site in two different locations, which excited us too, because hopefully that's two separate clutches of snakes, two juveniles. So our field biologist from the OCIC, a woman named Michelle Hoffman, she estimated that when we found the snakes on site, that they were probably about 3 months old, a little less than 2 feet long each one. And as I said, they were found in two separate locations. So we don't have documentation yet of their genetic heritage. All the snakes that are released have been profiled genetically, but I don't think we have the results yet of to whether or not we can determine the parentage of those two juveniles to conclusively say if they're from separate parents. But the fact that they were found about 2 miles apart gives us some hope that it might have been two separate, you know, events, two separate nests.
Would you take some kind of sample from them to figure this out?
Yes. So the OCIC does all sorts of testing before the snakes are released, the juveniles. Obviously, we know who their parents are because the director is picking the parents to breed together to, you know, ensure genetic diversity as best as we can. And so they know the genetics of the snakes. Then, you know, you can take different swabs from the cloaca to get different information about disease or genetic information. And we also have a new technique that's been tested over the past year or so, which is a method called eDNA, which is environmental DNA. It's a way of surveying for animals that are no longer physically at the location. So you can sample sand or dirt and check for genetic material left behind, like, you know, as if a human were to leave a skin cell, you know, skin cells, like from your hairbrush or something, you know. So that's a new method that's being tested to try to get additional help surveying, because it takes a lot of time to be out there wandering around looking for things.
Yeah,
you also have cameras too now, right?
Yeah, we have drift fences set up, which essentially our fence is made of that silt fence material that you might see on the side of the road for erosion control. But we set these up in about 100-foot sections, two arms, like in a cross shape often or a plus shape. So you have 100 feet and then perpendicular to that another 100 feet. We have a camera, a game camera set up in the middle pointing straight down at the sand. So that the idea is, hey, if a snake encounters this, or other animals, really, any animal, they end up kind of just walking along the fence until it ends or slithering along. And hopefully they go under that camera and get their picture taken. So we have a method of, you know, kind of documenting where snakes are. That's great for temporal coverage. You can have those cameras out all the time, but then they're stationary. They're not moving. So you're only getting that particular location sampled. That's complemented by Michelle and her staff going out and doing the surveys by foot. So that's great spatial coverage, right? They can walk all over the preserve, but it's only that moment in time that they've passed by that space or that burrow, you know, to find if a snake is there. They could go away and 5 minutes later, a snake slithers by and they'll never see it.
Right. Yeah.
So the eDNA is kind of splitting the difference because you can take this sample from wherever, you know, you go to a burrow and look at the mouth of the burrow and you can sample some sand there and collect it and have it analyzed for eDNA. So you can do that wherever. And the fact that the animal's not there, but their DNA has been left behind, the experiment that they were working on over the past year was to try to figure out how long of a time can go by and that DNA still be detectable.
Mm.
Is it an hour? Is it a week? Is it 3 days? You know, so they're processing all that right now. But it would split the difference, right? Because you can collect a sample from anywhere. And maybe if you weren't there right when the snake was, but it was there 3 days before, you can still tell that it was there and you can identify it.
That's really cool. Does rain impact this?
I'm not sure. I can't remember if that's been a component of it. I mean, it's kind of captured by the time frame. So if there had been rain in that 3 days, say, between when the snake was there, you collected the sample, that's kind of going to be factored into the design. I'm not the one running that study. It's some folks, I think, out of Colorado. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they've how they incorporate like weather conditions into their analysis.
Mm-hmm.
But gotcha. I would imagine that they do. And that plays a factor into like, hey, it rained. So that kind of impacts our detectability.
Yeah. How detectable are they? I mean, you're describing all these different ways of finding them. It seems like in such a large landscape with so many places to hide.
I think certainly for the walking surveys, they try to cover as much ground as possible, focusing on some of the released areas, because obviously we know snakes were there, so you kind of have that bias already. Like, yeah. Well, we know we let 40 snakes go in these places, so let's check there first. But then we have a pretty good record of where gopher tortoise burrows are across the landscape. We've spent a lot of time, recording locations of tortoise burrows. So we'll target the gopher tortoise burrows. We'll walk around and look at the burrows and see if there are any tracks like David had found from that audio clip from earlier. So we'll make notes of that. Hey, if you see tracks but there's no snake, let's go back and visit that again or set up something temporarily like to see if we can catch a snake there or just revisit it. Use a gopher tortoise burrow scope to see if there's a snake in the burrow. So it's kind of you just get out there and having more people certainly helps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these snakes don't hurt people.
That's correct. They are not interested in humans. And really, if you think about what a snake is doing when it bites you, or if you are that unlucky to have a venomous snake, or even some of the non-venomous snakes, if you're harassing it, it's like a black racers are kind of notorious for that. You know, they'll latch on, but they're doing it as a defense, right? I mean, the main reason a snake, a venomous snake in particular, would bite you is to eat whatever it is that they're biting. Well, they're not going to eat a human. You know, we're even though they can dislocate their jaws and stuff, we're still too big for them, right? So, you know, they're not really that interested in biting us other than in defense. And the indigos themselves are just, like Rob said, they're very docile. And when people are out surveying and you see them curled up by the gopher tortoise burrow or just kind of out on the landscape, in that audio clip, David Prentice just grabbed the snake. You know, the snake, there was no crazy reaction from him like, oh, no, the snake is biting me or, you know, getting aggressive. So these snakes will just let you pick them up. And again, that was one of the reasons they were so attractive to the pet trade people back in the day because they were easy. You know, they're just kind of a chill animal.
Great.
Yeah,
and they sound beautiful.
They are beautiful, and, you know, you can enjoy looking at them if you get a good chance to see one. They're not interested in bothering us.
Yeah. Do people see them a lot on the trail? You ever hear an account of someone on the Garden of Eden, like, I saw an indigo snake?
I have not, But it is possible because we have a neighbor to the south of the trail who has found one in his yard. Oh. So it's a possible, but I've never heard of anyone specifically seeing one. Now, that maybe someone has and they just didn't mention it, but
yeah,
it's possible.
So the next release is coming up at the end of April.
That's correct.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Any last words you want people to know about this snake and why we should care about its well-being?
I think for anyone who appreciates the natural world and the natural environment, this is just one more thing that we can do to help out our natural communities in Florida. We are so lucky in this state to have really cool natural features, and you know, whether it's the springs or the Everglades or the sandhills of North Florida and the Red Hills, you know, near Tallahassee, it's all unique parts of our heritage in Florida, and the indigo snake is part of that. And so it belongs here just like we do. So it's cool to be able to be part of having that component back in North Florida.
Yeah, and having an apex predator on the landscape, you know, we don't think about this, but in North Florida, we used to have Florida panthers up here. We used to have red wolves that roamed freely, you know, and they play a part in our ecosystems, even if humans have a fear of these animals. But, you know, they provide a certain amount of balance between all the, you know, the lower predators and the plant consumers and the plant species. So it's cool to have an apex predator out on the landscape.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Preserve Manager Catherine Ricketts with the Nature Conservancy in Florida and Rob Diaz de Villegas of WFSU's Ecology Blog. We appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thanks,
Gina.
If you want to see photos and videos of indigo snakes, I've got you covered. I've been covering them and the Apalachicola Bluffs and Ravines region for years. It's all at WFSU.org/ecologyblog.